deprive the defendant of his right to present evidence upon an essential element of the crime. One's hard-pressed to think of any other example of such a drastic rule. There is certainly a slight partiality in rules which permit the prosecution to introduce evidence that has any tendency to make a fact of consequence to the determination of the action more probable or less probable than it would be without the evidence, while holding the defendant to this standard. While states are relatively free to devise and apply their own rules of evidence, there are at least some constitutional limitations upon the degree to which an evidentiary device can be used to preclude the criminal defendant from presenting relevant evidence of innocence. And there is a cite contained there. The difficulty an expert would have in testifying was illustrated by Dr. Bloom's testimony before you Wednesday, when he indicated he felt the person would have to be unconscious. I am at a loss to imagine what the effect is on lay opinion evidence of insanity. Let me move to some procedural incidents of the proposed bill. 2075, the interim committee bill, provides that after conviction, either prosecutor or defendant, either, may seek a disposition hearing based upon an allegation that the defendant lacked capacity. The court may consider evidence presented at trial or hearing, and if persuaded of the fact, shall sentence the defendant to the maximum. There are similar provisions in 2269, except that the maximum sentence is not per se required. Both bills then contain a designation of offenses, prohibit conditional release or leave of absence, and direct the defendant's transfer to the corrections division to serve the remainder of the sentence upon discharge. It's unnecessary to dwell upon the therapeutic advantages of such a system. The prospect of criminal confinement as a reward for recovery is at least interesting and novel, but I suspect it's not a carrot to the taste of many mules. I'm concerned with a different aspect. 2269 obviously contemplates the possibility that the state will seek this disposition in Section 3. This is not unrealistic in view of Wednesday's testimony that the state has done so in the past under current laws. Here, we have the possibility of a high sentence, and there is a realistic incentive to do so again. Even though the defendant opposes the disposition, the burden of proof is placed upon the defendant at the hearing. The effect of the mandatory maximum sentence under House Bill 2075 would seem to offer a similar incentive to a prosecutor. The inequality of requiring such a punishment for the mentally ill patient is patent. It would also seem to constitute an unreasonable punishment for asserting this defense. In the absence of the provision for discharge to the correction system, the sentence could be viewed as merely a maximum designed to provide the mental health system with leeway. That view is more difficult to accept under a proposed system such as this, where invidious comparison with sentences imposed upon the class of non-incapacitated offenders unavoidable. Without suggesting the present system is perfect, it appears preferable to the alternatives presented. Criminal conviction like incarceration or any other restriction on civil liberties should be justified. Criminal conviction of the insane is not justifiable by any of the traditional objectives of punishment. Retribution, or the current jargon, just deserts, is inappropriate because the action of an insane person is no more blameworthy than an accident or the action of a very young child. Insane persons lack the qualities conducive to deterrence. While prevention of future harm through isolation and rehabilitation may be appropriate goals, they do not require a criminal conviction as a predicate. The modeling or educational value of the criminal law is not served because most of us do not view ourselves within the class of people affected. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Be delighted to respond to any questions if I can.
Thank you, Professor. Appreciate the time and preparing the program. Are there questions at this time? Thank you very much for coming over.
Mr. Penn?
Mr. Chairman, I
Chairman, and Mr. Paul, I'm here to testify, I would have no problem with allowing him to go first, if he could be committee with which that.
Fine, whatever.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, Dave Frohnmeyer, representing the Department of Justice, testifying on the generic subject. The committee has heard my views at some length and has also heard views which differ from those which I've advanced. And rather than engage in an extensive colloquy at this point, let me simply try to make four points which I hope will bring the discussion, or focus the discussion at least, on the track which we believe is appropriate. First one of those is not to regard, and I hope that no one on the committee regards the ALI Model Penal Code test as the be-all and end-all, the ultimate historical development of how we treat those who are criminally insane and not responsible in our society. There is no time-honored tradition behind that test, and indeed that test stands or falls, it seems to me, on the results that it has developed. In the state of Oregon, that test is only 10 years or 11 years old. In my original testimony to this committee, I've demonstrated to you with statistics that I believe in that respect are unassailable, the dramatic increase in the successful use of an insanity defense once Oregon departed from the McNaughton test and adopted the ALI Model Penal Code test, which was involved in the criminal code revision of 1972. And so if there is, in fact, a tenfold increase in the use of that plea successfully, at least that suggests that it's an appropriate avenue for this committee to investigate as to whether that ought to be the final formulation for all time of this particular standard of criminal responsibility. I suggest to you that it's not. The second point I wish to make, in case it needs any reinforcement at all, is that with respect to the testimony and data that I have offered to the committee, I hope it is clear that the Psychiatric Security Review Board is in no way the target of my remarks or my concern. The PSRB has dramatically improved both the length of stay issue and the release question as far as Oregon citizens are concerned, and I think its work has been exemplary. But the issue as to whether or not NBC's white paper or any of us approve of the actions of the PSRB is really peripheral to the concern that we have advanced to this committee. We're concerned about intake into the system through a test with it, which is excessively vague and subjective and unscientific, not with respect to what happens to the person who is admitted to the custody of the board. And I think those issues need to be separated. The fact that this committee may find, and indeed should find, that the PSRB is an appropriate model experimental system that should be duplicated around the United States has nothing to do with the question as to whether the test by which people enter its jurisdiction is an appropriate one or not. The third point I would ask the committee to consider with care is the data advanced to the committee and reiterated by virtually every witness who is opposed to change in one form or another to the insanity defense as it's written. That is the argument bolstered by documentation from Mr. Rogers, Dr. Bloom, and others with respect to the high degree of stipulations to the insanity defense by both defense and prosecution. I suggest to you respectfully that you view those statistics with some caution for two reasons. Not because the stipulations did not occur. I've advised the committee, I think, at a very early date that I was aware that many insanity defenses are caused by stipulation. The question I think one has to ask and probe more than the present data probably allows to be done is why were those stipulations made? And I can offer you two reasons which it seems to me are legitimate ones for the committee to explore and satisfy itself on with respect to that. First of all, and it's a question that you may wish to direct to Mr. Penn, who's in the trenches on these issues and who could testify from his own experience. The very expense of prosecution and defense psychiatrists, psychologists, usually born at the expense of the state, may make stipulation an attractive alternative to conducting a criminal trial over what may be a relatively minor offense. So there are incentives in the very system itself because of its expense that lead to the issue of stipulation. The second thing that has to be remembered is that the issue of stipulated agreements on this issue cannot be separated from the breadth and subjectivity of the test, which is the background and the context for the very stipulation itself. It is our contention that the very breadth and subjectivity of that test means that many people will, in fact, be stipulated because under the looseness of that formulation, it is obvious to the prosecution that the individual could not successfully, his claim could not successfully be contended, even though under a more scientific and precise test, that stipulation would not be forthcoming. Finally, with respect to the issue of the volitional test, the volitional arm of the test as to whether the individual is able to conform his or her conduct to the requirements of the law, I respectfully take issue with my friend Jeff Rogers, who offered that that test does not need change in any respect. Bear in mind that the American Psychiatric Association has introduced its Blue Ribbon Panel report, published in December 1982, which was widely publicized and which many of this committee probably have read. In that report, the American Psychiatric Association itself recommends substantial modification of that volitional arm of the test, precisely because it does not lend itself adequately to scientific or medical judgments, but rather has become a legal quagmire in which the line between what is the proper province of law and medicine has been blurred. Concludes my remarks, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Dave. Questions? Attorney General, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Tim?
My name is Dale Penn, and I'm a deputy district attorney here in Marion County. I'm representing the Oregon District Attorney's Association. My purpose in offering testimony today is, in effect, to perhaps clarify some of the issues that you would be dealing with in this work session. You've heard a lot of testimony by primarily people opposed to the bills. There's not a lot of talk about the specifics of the bills. I want to echo the one statement of the Attorney General that none of these bills, and certainly from the district attorney's point of view, there is no intent to attack the PSRB or the job they're doing or their function that they have. I think they do an excellent job. And none of these bills are really designed to change their function or what they do. There are some minor tinkerings with the PSRB authority in each of the bills. However, each one of those changes essentially allows some added powers of the PSRB in revoking conditional releases, except for the one amendment in the interim committee bill, which originally was going to restrict the ability of the PSRB to conditionally release. But that has now been amended. The point of these bills, at least from the district attorney's point of view, and I think from observing the testimony at the interim committee stage, the point is at the beginning of the criminal prosecution. And I think you must understand that there is essentially an iron curtain that draws down in any criminal trial, and that iron curtain is the verdict and the sentence by the judge. At that time, the PSRB becomes involved. And at that time, the PSRB utilizes a test which is different and which has nothing to do with the test of mental disease prior to that point, the test of the mental disease defense which you are looking over in these bills. The PSRB will simply look at, is the person affected by a mental disease or defect, and is that person dangerous? Those are the issues. Whether or not they can appreciate criminality or conform conduct, that is something that the PSRB has nothing to do with. Let me also suggest to you that these bills have nothing whatsoever to do with the issues of whether or not a person is competent to stand trial, whether or not that person is able to aid and assist in the defense of his case, and it has nothing to do with those people that are so insane that they are unable to have any conception of where they are, what they are doing. That is the classic example which I think is proposed. Anytime someone talks about the mental disease, we hear statements about the person who thinks that he's squeezing grapes when he's strangling a person, or the person who thinks that he's killing a dragon when in fact he is shooting a human being. Those are not people that are addressed in this, in these amendments. We're dealing with what is the defense. And the reason why these have been proposed to you is because the defense, as it is now stated, is wide open. There are no parameters whatsoever. It allows any person with a degree or a defense attorney to walk in and make any proposal that under these facts, mental disease is an issue. I've had cases where one psychiatrist stood up and testified that this person was mentally ill because he was a member of the Russian Orthodox community out here in Woodburn. He committed a crime against another member of the Russian Orthodox community. He was ostracized from that community because it was a violation of his church rules. And this was a very severe sanction among this group of people. The psychiatrist interviewed the defendant. The defendant told him, I fear my friends. I fear that I will be ostracized. In fact, he had been ostracized, but because that psychiatrist had no understanding of the makeup of that sub-community in this Woodburn area, he identified that as a mental disease and that this was a schizophrenic response to the crime itself, and therefore he should be excused responsibility. Now, that type of argument should not have been even posed in a court of law because it doesn't even come close to qualifying as a mental disease defense. It wasn't successful, but it required a trial to determine that it is not a potential a defense there. It's that type of situation that we're asking for some parameters to be imposed so that when we say the mental disease defense, we can look in the statute and we know that there are cases that can fit inside that defense rather than saying the whole world is open and whatever you want to argue is permissible, because that is the state of law at the present point. I personally am opposed to the mental disease defense under the ALI test, because when the ALI test was formulated and adopted in Oregon 10 years ago, but formulated some years before, the testimony before that body was that the present state of the art in psychiatry and clinical psychology established that we can make these decisions as psychiatrists and clinical psychologists. We can tell you when someone lacks substantial capacity to conform or to appreciate. I would ask the committee reform that test now, because as this has been established by the American Psychiatric Association, that national body has stated there is absolutely no consensus among psychiatrists throughout the United States what this test of conforming conduct, what that means at all. We don't have any idea. And under that state of affairs, it is tantamount to perpetuating a fraud in the legal system by allowing that to be a defense when no one can tell us what that is. Mr. Rogers used an example, this week, but at the earlier hearing, about the fact that there is no problem at the present time. And if the committee would do nothing, that this might be the best thing that could be done. I would disagree with that. He used as an example that there are many defenses that create problems. The alibi defense. Many times you'll have two sets of witnesses, a credibility issue, who's telling the truth, what actually happened. And perhaps you don't know at the end of the trial what actually happened. But in an alibi defense, at least there is some historical truth. Either on this date, at the time of the crime, the defendant was present or he was not. That is the historical truth. And if the trial is a search for truth, whether it's successful or not can be judged on what the truth was. Perhaps the trial does not establish what the truth was. But there is historical truth present, and there is guidance in how to determine that historical truth. In the mental disease defense, there is no historical truth because there is no test and there is no one that can stand up and tell you what substantial capacity is. There is no one who can stand up and tell you what appreciating criminality is. There is no objective testing available for that. And psychiatrists, if they're truthful with you, and many of them were with before the interim committee, and Representative Courtney heard this testimony. They stood up and said, we need definitions because we don't know what this means. Given that state of the art, or that state of the affairs, where there is no historical truth, where no one can stand up and make definitions, how can we determine what the truth is? How can we determine whether or not this person should be held responsible, should be guilty or not guilty, when no one can tell us that? There is no guidelines. We are asking these bills to set down, to take out a drastic problem area, personality disorders. I think the PSRB and Mr. Rogers and others have stated that this is an immense problem area, and I would agree. It allows a psychiatrist to come in and say, because the Russian Orthodox community is applying pressure, that this is a personality disorder and therefore it should be a mental disease. That should not be allowed, and a prosecutor should be able to go before the court and say, Your Honor, there should not be an instruction given on that kind of testimony. It does not rise to the level of mental disease. We need some tools to do that, and that is essentially what these three bills are doing. I would only highlight also that the ODAA bill is, again, essentially three or four major amendments to the interim committee bill. And what we're suggesting in that, if the committee would not adopt the Attorney General's bill, which is what the ODAA is supporting, because we feel it accomplishes the reform and it does it in a simplified manner, and it puts forth the major areas that all three bills point to. If the committee cannot decide upon that bill, that you carefully analyze the amendments proposed by the ODAA to the interim committee bill, because we feel if you do not address those amendments, there will be some severe constitutional problems with the State versus Wedge case primarily. There needs to be some definitions in there if the court, as a sentencing court and the fact finder, are making different decisions. I feel that it will not pass judicial scrutiny. And also the safety net proposal, and also putting in the sentencing judge to look at the issue of dangerousness, because that's what the PSRB does. Those are really the three major amendments we proposed, and I can go into more detail about why we feel those are necessary. But primarily, I want to answer the question that Jeff Rogers posed to you. Why change? Why change? Because the criminal law is supposed to be at least a search for the truth. And in all these other cases, in all these other defenses, we do have historical truth available. There is none in mental disease or defect. And because of that, it leaves it wide open for abuse. We have a tremendous public relations problem in the criminal justice system with the public. And this is one defense that they do not like. And I think one reason is because many people can see that there is no historical truth, no guidelines, no ruler to judge when this defense is appropriate. And that is primarily what the Department of Justice bill is designed to do, and also what our amendments to the interim committee bill are designed to do. Give some guidelines. What is it? Is the defense now structured to search for the truth? I think it's appropriate for the committee to understand that when you look at whether or not someone is mentally ill in a criminal trial, what those opinions are based upon is usually an hour and a half examination. Maybe if you have someone who can take a lot of time, you might have 3-hour examination, or maybe 2-hour and a half examinations by the defense psychiatrist. The state psychiatrist is not allowed access to that defendant for a psychiatric examination until after notice is given of that defense. Now, you would look at the present statute and say, well, at arraignment, the defense attorney is supposed to give notice of this defense. Let me tell you that there is also a provision there, or for good cause shown, and in my experience, notice is never given of mental disease until far down the road, perhaps months after the crime, and yet the defense is designed to examine what is the mental condition of the defendant at the very moment of the crime. We're asking the psychiatric profession and clinical psychology to project backwards and tell us, what was this person thinking 3 months ago?
and we're going to ask you to talk to this person and adopt what he is telling you as the historical truth, when obviously he's incarcerated or he's charged with a serious crime, and if there's anyone who is present with a motive to fabricate or at least to shade the facts, it is that person. And yet that is primarily the basis for all psychiatric and clinical psychological opinions on the mental condition at the time of the crime. We ask them to project backwards, and yet both of those professions will tell us that if we ask them to project forward, we can't do that, and we don't want that responsibility. We're asking them to do something that's impossible. No objective criteria, there's no standards. One other thing, the prosecution psychiatrist, again, and whether or not this is a search for the truth, he may be allowed to examine the defendant at some later time, and yet he is restricted from asking any questions of the defendant about the crime itself. Now, occasionally you will have a defense attorney who will say, I am so confident that this person is mentally ill and could not appreciate criminality that I'll allow your expert to ask him anything you want to. But let me propose to you that that is the rare exception. And in 90% of the exams in cases that I try, my psychiatrist is never allowed to ask any questions about the day of the crime, and yet he is supposed to give opinion about the defendant's mental state at the moment of the crime. The defense as it is structured, without any criteria, without any standards, with the restrictions that are imposed, is not a search for the truth. And I've tried to lay that out in my position paper for the ODAA. It's a brief three-page letter. There's no details in there. It just kind of scratches the surface. But those are some real severe problems in the present system at the intake level. And I can tell you that although at the bottom of the funnel, that the PSRB will tell you that most of these people are mentally ill and their appropriate commitments, I can tell you that the battle is fought out at the beginning where there is no criteria whatsoever, where we have to have examinations and where we have to go through more or less a dog and pony show or a strategic chess game in trying to convince a defense attorney that this defense will not fly. And this is why it's no good, and this is why my experts are better, or this is why your expert doesn't know what he's talking about. And there's a lot of expense and manpower expended in that, and I think those are the reasons why this defense needs to be amended, needs to be changed, and I think that the amendments before you can accomplish that and have been well thought out and will be a proposal that will allow the Oregon system to be the primary system in the United States, as the PSRB may be now. I think the entire system can be a model.
What is your view of the explanation of the frequency with which stipulations are being entered into? The Attorney General is touching on that. In your experience, do you feel those stipulations are purely tactical, shall we say, or to what extent do they reflect a judgment that, in all probability, the assertion of the defense would be successful, and well, properly so on the facts?
I can tell you that, unfortunately, a lot of prosecution these days has to be geared with the idea of what resources do we have available and what fiscal resources do we have available. And I can tell you that, I think you've already heard testimony that a large majority of the people at the PSRB right now are not on murder or robbery or some of the real dangerous crimes, but a lot of them are there on UUV and thefts and burglaries. And although burglary is certainly a crime that would have an impact on the community, but as far as being personally dangerous, there are a lot of commitments on these lesser crimes. I cannot justify a full-blown psychiatric trial on a UUV case when I have, particularly in Marion County, in our present state of affairs, that is a real problem. I'm sure that enters into stipulations throughout the state. I will tell you that in our county, however,
I can only think of a couple of stipulations in the past couple of years, because we have tried consciously to cut back on those stipulations, because the more work we do in the area, the more loopholes and the more we realize that the defense is an invitation for abuse. And if you dig hard enough, and if you're able to spend enough time and enough resources in the important cases, you can see that it's inappropriate. That was what the Moore case was all about. People, and you've heard testimony before you, the Museum Tavern shooting out here in Salem 2 years ago. You've heard testimony, well, obviously this man was mentally ill, and therefore the proper verdict, or the truth in this case, was that he should have been committed to the state hospital. I don't agree with that at all. Mental illness of itself does not mean that guilt should be excused. And I hope that everyone realizes that. People gloss over that from time to time, and I guess it's a pet peeve that I have. Mental illness merely means that you get to the point where you start investigating whether the defense should be proposed. There are other tests that must be complied with, and just because someone is mentally ill doesn't mean that they're going to commit a crime. I think you've heard Dr. Bloom testify that probably 85% of schizophrenics do not commit crimes at all. Mental illness and schizophrenia does not mean that you will commit crimes.